This is April 25th, is it?
That's right.
Thanks. April 25th, 2010. And I think we just passed the annual observance of Earth Day. Was that, when was that?
22nd.
Okay, the 22nd. And we have, in 6 days, we have our symposium, the Zen Center is sponsoring a symposium on the environment. It's called Turning Toward the Earth. And it's a conversation with leading environmentalists and Buddhists. And so it was not surprising then that turning over my mind what I might comment on today, it was the environment and climate change and everything related to our symposium. And it prompted me to ferret out of my piles of magazines and articles at home this one from about a year ago. It's the cover story in the Sunday New York Times Magazine, and that's actually April 19th, 2009, almost exactly a year ago. And the article, they have several articles in here about the environment, and the one that I found myself drawn to this morning is called "Why Isn't the Brain Green?" And the subtitle is "Decision Scientists Are Trying to Figure Out Why It's So Hard for Us to Get Into a Green Mindset. Their Answers May Be More Crucial Than Any Technological Advance in Combating Environmental Challenges." It's a long enough article that I'll just have to skip from paragraph to paragraph. It focuses on the work of the Center for Research on Environmental Decisions. Notice it's not environmental data itself, the research into the environment and the changes in the environment, but the Center for Research on Environmental Decisions. It's a branch of behavioral, the author, got to give credit, the author is John Gertner. It says a branch of behavioral research situated at the intersection of psychology and economics, decision science focuses on the mental processes that shape our choices, behaviors, and attitudes. It originated mostly out of the work of two psychologists in the 1970s, whose experiments demonstrated that people can behave unexpectedly when confronted with simple choices. We have many automatic biases. We're more averse to losses than we are interested in gains, for instance. We're more averse to losses than we are interested in gains. And we make repeated errors in judgment based on our tendency to use shorthand rules to solve problems. We can also be extremely susceptible to how questions are posed. And then he gives an example. Would you undergo surgery if it had a 20% mortality rate? What if it had an 80% survival rate? It's the same procedure, of course, but in various experiments, responses from patients can differ markedly. And then he mentions that a lot of research has been done in how we make decisions in financial settings or when confronted with choices having to do with healthcare and consumer products. And this article more focuses on decision-making related to environmental issues. This Center for Research on Environmental Decisions It's got a nifty acronym, CRED. It got help from a National Science Foundation grant, $6 million. Its main objective is studying how perceptions of risk and uncertainty shape our responses to climate change and other weather phenomena like hurricanes and droughts. The goal, in other words, isn't so much to explore theories about how people relate to nature, which has been a long-time pursuit of some environmental psychologists and even academics like the Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson. Rather, it is to finance laboratory and field experiments in North America, South America, Europe, and Africa, and then place the findings within an environmental context. In the United States, he says, nearly all dollars for climate investigation are directed toward physical or biological projects. And the notion that vital environmental solutions will be attained through social science research instead of improved climate models or innovative technologies is an aggressively insurgent view. You might ask the decision scientists, as I did, if they aren't overcomplicating matters. Doesn't a low-carbon world really just mean phasing out coal and other fossil fuels in favor of clean energy technologies, domestic regulations, and international treaties? None of them disagreed. Some smiled patiently. But all of them wondered if I had underestimated the countless group and individual decisions that must precede any widespread support for such technologies or policies. Let's start with the fact that climate change is anthropogenic. Elke Weber, who holds a chair at Columbia's Business School, as well as an appointment in the school's psychology department. Let's start with the fact that climate change is anthropogenic, she said. More or less, people have agreed on that. That means it's caused by human behavior. Well, we know that there are many people who deny that, don't believe it. But anyway, it does seem from what I've read and heard that the vast, vast majority of scientists agree that it seems to be caused by human behavior. She goes on, that's not to say that engineering solutions aren't important, but it's caused by human behavior. And if it's caused by human behavior, then the solution probably also lies in changing human behavior. It says that the CRED researchers consider global warming a singular opportunity to study how we react to long-term trade-offs in the form of sacrifices we might make now in exchange for uncertain climate benefits far off in the future. And the research also has the potential to improve environmental messages, policies, and technologies so that they are more in tune with the quirky workings of our minds. And then he reports that when he visited one of her classes that one day in Columbia, Weber was giving a primer on how people tend to reach decisions. Cognitive psychologists now broadly accept that we have different systems for processing risks. One system works analytically, often involving a careful consideration of costs and benefits. The other experiences risk as a feeling, a primitive and urgent reaction to danger, usually based on a personal experience that can prove invaluable when, for example, we wake at night to the smell of smoke. There are some unfortunate implications here. In analytical mode, we are not always adept at long-term thinking. Experiments have shown a frequent dislike for delayed benefits. Duh. So we undervalue promised future outcomes. And then in parentheses, he says, given a choice, we usually take $10 now as opposed to, say, $20 2 years from now. Environmentally speaking, this means we are far less likely to make lifestyle changes in order to ensure a safer future climate. Letting emotions determine how we assess risk presents its own problems. Almost certainly, we underestimate the danger of rising sea levels or epic droughts or other events that we've never experienced and seem far away in time and place. We underestimate the danger of rising sea levels and so forth because it's remote in time and place. Worse, Weber's research seems to help establish that we have a, quote, finite pool of worry, which means we're unable to maintain our fear of climate change when a different problem comes along, like a plunging stock market or a personal emergency. We simply move one fear into the worry bin and one fear out. And even if we could remain persistently concerned about a warmer world, Reb Weber described what she calls a single action bias. And that's when we're prompted by a distressing emotional signal, we buy a more efficient furnace or insulate our attic or vote for a green candidate. A single action that effectively diminishes global warming as a motivating factor. And that leaves us where we started. Debates over why climate change isn't higher on Americans' list of priorities tend to center on the same culprits: the doubt-sowing remarks of climate change skeptics, the poor communication skills of good scientists, the political system's inability to address long-term challenges without a thunderous precipitating event, and the tendency of science journalism to focus more on what is unknown, and then in parentheses, will oceans rise by 2 feet or five? To focus more on what is unknown than what is known and is durably frightening. The oceans are rising. I think this is a very important article for all the reasons that the author gives, that yes, we need to do everything we can to change our technologies, our policies, public policies, and all, but so much of this comes down to public opinion. Unfortunately, this is the great outrages of modern life in America, is that people think that their opinions, their beliefs, trump scientific evidence. This just slays me when you see on CNN or other news outlets, people asking, what do you think? Is climate change overrated, or who cares what people think or believe or what their opinion is when it comes to evaluating such enormously complex and sometimes conflicting evidence? Although it does seem that with climate change there isn't, it's pretty overwhelming in one direction. It therefore takes tremendous resistance and denial to claim that it's not happening. But he goes on to explore that too. How is it that people are so stubborn about denying the overwhelming evidence, or at least the evidence offered by overwhelming majority of scientists? And skipping here a little more, because CRED's primary goal is to understand decision-making in situations of uncertainty, the wind turbine question Oh, excuse me, I didn't mark this. He reports on an experiment where at Columbia, where subjects had to deal with several quandaries. The first involved reaching a consensus on how to apply $5 billion worth of federal funds to wind energy technologies. Should they spend it all on conventional wind turbines? Should they invest some or all of the money on an as yet unproven technology that would employ magnetic levitation to create a huge, long-lasting, super-efficient wind power generator? After the group came to a consensus in each of the test segments, its members were asked to go into the offices and figure out their own individual decisions. It turned out the researchers had little curiosity about what we think of wind power, because CRED's primary goal is to understand decision-making in situations of uncertainty. The wind turbine question: should we spend money on building turbines now with a proven technology, or should we finance technologies that might be more efficient someday? That question was intriguing, not for its content, but for the way it revealed how our minds work. The familiar variables were all there: uncertainty, time, potential gains, potential losses. Now, one of the reasons this article grabbed my attention this morning was because this is exactly what the trustees and officers are struggling with right now with regard to geothermal energy technology at Chapin Mill. We sent out in a recent mailing to the Sangha about, I don't know, 3 weeks ago or something, we sent out maybe a little prematurely it seems, an announcement that we had decided on going with geothermal heating for the final phase, that the final wing we're about to break ground on later in the next month, that we had decided on that. But then that kicked up some dust as to whether it's really cost-effective and all kinds of questions that I don't have time to get into here. But take my word for it, it has prompted a very lively discussion among the trustees and the officers and others involved in it about what's the best thing to do now. It's not so clear that geothermal heating is the best thing in either financially or even environmentally, except in the long run, it might be. And there's a lot of difficult decisions that are going to have to be made by 2 weeks from the day that decision will be made. It gets more and more complex in terms of these very things: uncertainty, time, potential gains, and potential losses. Cooperation seems to be make quite a difference in terms of what decision one comes to, or people come to. Various CRED experiments have established the ease of getting random individuals to cooperate. Getting a sense of group identity made quite a difference. Well, the trustees and officers certainly have that. They said that just seating people together at a table increased participation rates to 75%. Weber said that climate change can be viewed as a very large commons dilemma. A commons dilemma is not defined here, but to give a good example, a common commons dilemma is the textbook situation in which sheep herders have little incentive to act alone to preserve the grassy commons, and as a result suffer collectively from overgrazing. The best way to avoid such failure is by collaborating more, not less. We enjoy congregating, Weber said. We need to know we are part of groups. It gives us inherent pleasure to do this. And when we are reminded of the fact that we're part of communities, then the community becomes sort of the decision-making unit. That's how we make huge sacrifices, such as in World War II. This reminds me that we have a committee, I guess we're calling it, in the Sangha that got going last year. Members who meet and talk about various issues that we as a community might consider or work on more effectively together. Someone help me with the current name of that committee. Sangha Resource Committee, thank you. I love interactive teishos. I love collaborative teishos.
We do too.
Shout out. Just kidding. Okay. Moving along here. Okay, again, 98% of the federal financing for climate change research goes to the physical and natural sciences, with the remainder, 2%, apportioned to the social sciences. In science policy speak, that leftover percentage is typically referred to as human dimensions research. And this falls into one of three categories: the human activities that cause environmental change, the impacts of environmental change on people and society, and the human responses to those consequences. Much of CRED's research is about the human responses to the experiences of climate change. What makes CRED's work especially relevant, though, is that various human attitudes and responses can make the climate problem worse by leaving it unacknowledged or unaddressed. Attitudes such as, how can there be global warming when we had a frigid January? What's in it for me if I change the way I live? Apathetic and hostile responses to climate change, in other words, produce a feedback loop and reinforce the process of global warming. And then he explores some objections to lab experiments in the social sciences. I can't get into that. He reports on an experiment by an anthropologist at the University of California at Davis, who studied farmers in southern Uganda. He observed how the behavior of the region's poor farmers could be influenced by whether they listened to crucial rainy day radio broadcasts in groups or as individuals. Farmers in community groups, as Orlov described them to me, engaged in discussions that led to a consensus, and farmers made better use of the forecast. They might alter their planting date, he said, or use a more drought-resistant variety of seed. Those in the community groups also seem more satisfied with the steps they took to increase their yields. And then another, Anthony Lizorowitz, another CRED member who directs the Yale Project on Climate Change, began a multi-year field project when he drove to Anchorage, Alaska, in a camper with his wife and two-year-old son. He wanted to see He said, I had worked on some national studies about American perceptions of climate change, and one of the more clear findings was, and still is, that most Americans think about climate change as a distant problem, distant in time, distant in space. But in Alaska, there was already evidence of melting permafrost, insect-driven tree mortality, and diminished sea ice. So this researcher saw a great opportunity, and he went up there and began interviewing all kinds of scientists, journalists, environmental leaders, politicians, and in the farther northwest part of the state, indigenous tribal leaders. His data showed that the majority of Alaskans had indeed detected a change in climate and attributed it to man-made causes. But he found that deep perceptual gaps between urban Alaskans and there were those between urban and rural residents. And the reason, he concluded, was that because the urban Alaskans, their experience of climate change was limited. It was less than the rural ones. In sum, Alaskans were no more worried than the American public as a whole about climate change, and they were no more inclined than typical Americans to see it as a serious threat to themselves or to their communities. About half of them, in fact, considered climate change a long-term problem that required more study before acting. Yeah, let's take a few more decades to study the matter. the big problem here, one of the big problems, is that, just what they said, that if we don't experience it, if it is not something that we can verify through our personal experience, why are we to believe it? And it comes down to the same problem that's so common in modern life, is unless we have the direct experience, we don't know for sure. We have to rely on reports. We have to rely on the media. Our knowledge is mediated. It's like when the Bush administration was ginning up the war fever so he could justify going into Iraq, and it was pretty strong consensus that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, that he was just, you know, on the verge of unleashing. And that was such a good lesson, I think, for anyone open-minded enough to get the lesson, is that it turned out there weren't. And yet, the media sure bought into it, and what do we have to go on? How many of us have been to Iraq? How many were there and were counting supposed hidden weapons of mass destruction? It is a real dilemma. So we do the best we can. We use our discriminating intelligence. We use our critical faculties in trying to winnow out the wheat from the chaff in terms of what we see and hear and read about. Who can be sure about these things? One of the silly this objection. January? In January, there were all these unusual snowstorms in places like Washington D.C. and other places that don't get that. And then these clowns in Fox News and other who would say, well, right there, there's, how can we have global warming? We had a blizzard, we had a snowstorm in Washington. That, there it is, I rest my case. When in fact, from what I read, those kinds of unusual storms, in this case, happened because of the ocean temperatures in the Pacific Ocean had risen by 4 degrees, and they set up this whole chain of things that ends up with all the snow being dumped on us. it seems like even a fourth grade student could understand that you can't look at any one isolated place or time. You have to rely on all of the data that we can gather from the whole world. And the article distinguishes between frames and nudges. They're not quite the same. Frames, the way you frame something, is just a way to nudge people by using sophisticated messages mined from decision science research. Messages that resonate with particular audiences or take advantage of our cognitive biases, such as informing us that an urgent operation has an 80% survival rate. And this is something, these frames are something that many politicians have learned can make all the difference in how people vote. It's just words, basically. How you express an issue, such as the so-called death tax, used to be called the estate tax, and then some geniuses of manipulation turned it into the death tax. Nudges, more broadly, structure choices so that our natural cognitive shortcomings don't make us err, depending on whether you say tomato or tomato. Nudges, ideally, direct us gently toward actions that are in our long-term interest, such as automated retirement savings plans that circumvents our typical inertia. And then these two academics at the University of Chicago explain in their book that nudges can take advantage of technology like home meters, which have been shown to reduce electricity usage by making constant feedback available. These appeal to our desire for short-term satisfaction and being rewarded for improvement. Weber believes decision science isn't only about structuring choices or finding the right frame to get a better outcome. It's about identifying useful information that can be used for innovative products, policies, and scientific studies. She gives the example that the cherry farmers in Michigan didn't care about future temperatures as much as the date of the last spring frost. No one in research has been interested in trying to predict the date of the last spring frost, but maybe they should be. They've been trying to predict average temperatures and heat waves. Again, in terms of framing, the author reports an experiment in which a 2% fee added to an airline ticket was described to various subjects as either a carbon tax or a carbon offset. The subjects were told the fee would finance alternative energy and carbon reduction technologies. The one who came up with this, David Hardesty, predicted he would get different results from Democrats and Republicans, and that was indeed the case. Democrats were willing to pay a fee for an offset or a tax. Republicans were willing to pay for an offset, but not a tax. Clearly, the tax frame affected the outcome, very much so for Republicans. This is so humbling. To know how easily we are manipulated by the wording. And this is what where Zen practice offers so much, so many resources, our own natural resources, once our mind is cleared, as our mind clears and we come to have less static going on in our thoughts, then we come to see things more clearly, and do you have a better ability to discern, again, the true from the false. This comes about, I believe, because we through daily sitting, we see how rootless, how arbitrary, how random our mental processes are. These random thoughts that are just flitting through the mind all the time, and we come to see that words and concepts are just words and concepts. They're not the moon. They're the finger that points to the moon. They're not. They're symbols. They're representations. They're not the thing itself. And we can play with these words and concepts, and they have great impact on most people. But once we've started to see through them, we see the insubstantiality of these words and concepts through our zazen, then little by little, I believe firmly that we acquire the ability to see through media, especially manipulations through the media. This same researcher, David Hardesty, then asked his subjects to write down their thoughts in order as they decided whether to pay the tax or the offset. And they found that early thoughts seem to sway our opinion, biasing subsequent thoughts to support the early position. And then the author says, when I raised the issue of possible ethical dilemmas with Weber, she countered by claiming that government constantly tries to instill behaviors that are considered to be in society's best interests. There's no way around it, she told me. We're always trying to push some agenda. Take the decision to allow certain kinds of mortgages and securities to be sold that are now considered disastrous. In doing so, Weber said, we were privileging certain people and certain institutions, and for a long time we were pushing the idea that everyone should own a house. As for the question of manipulation, Weber contended that there is no neutral, value-free way of presenting people with information. I think you have to take it as a given that whatever we do, whether it's what we currently do or what we plan to do, has some value judgment built into it. The crucial question, at least to her, is whether and when we want to use the tools of decision science to try and steer people toward better choices. If our preferences aren't fixed the way we think they are, that is, if, as Weber has argued, they're sometimes merely constructed on the spot in response to a choice we face, why not try new methods, such as ordering our options, choosing strategic words, creating group effects, and so forth, to elicit preferences aligned with our long-term interests? That has to be better, she said, than having people blunder unconsciously into an environmental catastrophe. One conclusion I would suggest to all this is that we use our discriminating minds in making decisions, and we don't allow ourselves to just react to things based on just old conditioning and unconscious forces. Well, we can't do anything about the unconscious. What's unconscious is unconscious. We're not aware of it. But Zen practice offers a very solid way of unraveling the conditioning that blinds us to seeing things as they are. And this goes for either side of any debate. People who are knee-jerk environmentalists can also be operating out of just concepts, notions. You start with a notion, and then you just don't want to hear about the facts. You just want to hold to your principles, your ideas about it. This is what we're all very closely examining ourselves in this decision about geothermal heating at Chapin Mill. At least I am. I think everyone is. We're trying very hard not to base our decision on solid evidence and conscious processes rather than just knee-jerk reactions based on our ideology about things. I had this other article that I will read just a few sentences of about air conditioning. This is, I guess I might have known this to some degree, but it makes it more clear. The article is from the New York Times, 2006. still, yeah, the nature of the article, I think, would still hold that it's called ACDC, the diluted world of air conditioning, about how air conditioning takes indoor heat and pushes it outdoors. This increases the production of greenhouse gases, which warm the atmosphere. All over the country, power consumption is breaking records, and air conditioning is a huge reason why. And instead of fixing the outdoors, we're trying to escape it. That's the problem in Washington today. Policymakers aren't facing global warming because they aren't feeling it. They gave themselves air conditioning in the 1920s and 30s, long before the public got it. White House meetings and congressional hearings on climate change are doomed hours beforehand when the thermostats are set. 1 minute you're watching video of people sweltering in New Orleans, the next minute you're watching senators dispute the significance of greenhouse gases. Don't ask whether these people are living on the same planet. In effect, they aren't. Again, it's the difficulty of seeing beyond our direct experience and getting the bigger picture of that includes that which we can't immediately sense ourselves right now. Zen is the school of direct experience, no question about it. That is the hallmark of the Zen school, not what the texts say, not what the Buddha is supposed to have said, not what the great master has said, but our own direct experience through meditation and both in a small sense of meditation, the formal sense, and the wider sense of being aware and attentive everywhere we are. But Zen also would say, as would all of Buddhism, that our senses can deceive us. Direct experience isn't limited to what we sense. Our senses are very limited. Our senses tell us that we're all separate, which is simply not the whole truth. All right, our time is up. Let's stop now and recite the four vows.